Today at Reader's Corner, Chad Harback, author of the best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Baseball has inspired many works of fiction, including Chad Harback's best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding. But while the action is centered around a college team and its star shortstop, this is much more than a baseball book. The fallacy of perfection, the inevitability of change, and the power of friendship are just a few of the multi-layered themes explored in the novel, which is now out in paperback. Today, as players are reporting for baseball's annual spring training exercises, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Chad Harback. He spent nearly a decade writing The Art of Fielding, and it was finally published in 2011 to great fanfare and commercial success. The book also received widespread critical praise for its big-hearted and evocative story, its sensitive exploration of what could be termed the human condition, and for its finely drawn characters, which seem as real and vivid as the fictional Midwestern college where the book is set. Mr. Harback grew up in Wisconsin, graduated from Harvard University, and received his MFA from the University of Virginia. He is the co-founder and co-editor of the literary magazine N Plus One. The Art of Fielding is his first novel. Mr. Harback joins us via Skype for this interview. Chad Harback, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and it's great to have read your book. And I want to say right off the bat that I thought it was an outstanding read. I felt really good reading this book. When I finished, I was inspired. I felt more positive about humanity, the human condition, as I mentioned it. And that's saying something when this is fiction, when we're walking away from a story, a tale that you have told, based, I'm sure, on many experiences in your life. But in the end, it's just a book that even has a great baseball ending, I might add. I like that as a baseball fan. But let's start. I want to make sure we don't give too much away. So we're going to skirt around the plot a little bit, certainly skirt around the denouement, so we don't for sure give away its ending. But I do want to start in maybe a slightly unusual place. And that is your friend Keith Gessen, who works with you at N Plus One. And he wrote this thing called How a Book is Born, The Making of the Art of Fielding. And one of the things he said in that little piece, he said, meanwhile, the book grew and grew. He's referring, of course, to how many years it took you to get this thing together. And it became richer and richer and in all ways better. When you look back on it, was the fact that it took 10 years then a really good thing? I mean, I'm sure when you were going through it, it's like, oh my gosh, when is this going to be ready? But it looks to me like the 10 years, it actually contributes to the quality of your writing, the quality of the book, as opposed to these guys who are throwing out a book a year and who, of course, for the most part, are not doing literary fiction.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you're entirely right that, you know, the fact that it took me a decade to do it, I had the idea early in 2000, and the book came out in the fall of 2011. So 11 and a half years, really, between conception and birth, a pretty long gestation period. And yeah, I mean, as I was going through it, you know, it felt intensely painful a lot of the time. I was just beating myself up and kind of felt like, you know, I had kind of constructed my entire life such that I was able to work on this book and that, you know, I was kind of never going to move forward in my life until this book was done. And yet the book wasn't getting done. You know, it's a dark, you know, it feels really troubling when you've been working on the same project for 6 years, 7 years, and the end is not yet in sight. And, you know, your friends have kind of left you by the side of the road and said, we don't know if Chad's ever going to finish that book he's supposedly working on. And there were a lot of dark times along the way, but yeah, I mean, I think in the end that it is really integral to the book. You know, the fact that I lived with these characters for 11 years, you know, so that I really felt like I knew them better than I probably know any actual living human beings and could just sort of think about these five people's lives inside and out from any angle. Different writers work differently, but I don't think I could do that with characters who I had only known for 6 months or a year. So I think there was a richness that was added in that process. And also, I think there's the fact that the book kind of spanned different eras of my life. It's a book about college, and I started writing it not too long, maybe about 2 years after I graduated from college, 3 years, I suppose. And I was 35 when it was published. So it felt to me like a project that I had begun in kind of youth and certain kind of naivete, and certainly with no idea how to write a novel. And I emerged from that process and was, by the time that process was finished, a completely different and more mature person. And I think that that's reflected in the book tonally. I think that it is a book that kind of bridges youth and adulthood in a kind of unique way. And that my next book will be quite different because I'll have begun it at a very different stage.
Of course. And by the way, is your next book a sequel to this one by any chance?
I can't believe I even mentioned the next one.
You're not supposed to, right?
I'm so superstitious about talking about it because I'm in the throes of it right now.
Okay, I got you. Well, by the way, our listeners might remember that Tony Doerr, our neighbor here in Boise, who just won the Pulitzer for All the Light We Cannot See, it took Tony 10 years to write his book. So you guys apparently have figured out something here that works. That's all I know.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the choice of the setting for this book. It's a small liberal arts college. You, on the other hand, went to Harvard and did an MFA at the University of Virginia. Why a small liberal arts college? What did that have to do with the message, if there is any at all, about the art of fielding?
The college in the book, Westish College, it's a little liberal arts school in Wisconsin, and it's a hybrid. I grew up in Wisconsin, and as you say, I went to Harvard, and I think the college is really a hybrid of growing up in Wisconsin and kind of immersed in Wisconsin and immersed in that place and feel like I know it better than any other place. And my own college experience at Harvard, which obviously is a institution that looms large, but only has like 6,000 undergrads. And actually I think can in some ways feel for a student like a smaller place. So I was kind of taking my college experience and transplanting it to very near the place where I grew up and to the soil of Wisconsin. And there are a lot of reasons why that place, wound up being the place that it was. I mean, in some ways, I think I was probably just constructing the school that I would have most liked to attend.
This is Reader's Corner, and our guest today is Chad Harbach, author of The Art of Fielding. The novel centers around a shortstop named Henry Scrimshander and what happens after he fires off a throw that goes terribly wrong. Well, you can imagine what it's like for me, a college president who's a baseball fan, to read your book. I mean, I have to admit that it's a lot more difficult for me to set a book down like that and to wonder what you're getting at as you write this book. I got the biggest kick out of the fresh person. Your word for the first-year student was not freshman, but fresh person. I mean, that's the way these folks at Westish, that's what they called themselves. As a matter of fact, the Atlantic Monthly just wrote an article about the coddling of the American mind and how now we're being pressured to use trigger warnings to protect students from words and ideas that might be offensive of one kind or another. Fresh person's a little different case than that, but tell me about the choice of fresh person. Was this your own little personal dig, or do you think that it's time to move on from freshman or first-year student?
Well, it's funny that you bring that up. I mean, I have to say that the fact that I use that term really enraged a lot of people. People would ask me about it at readings in a really befuddled way or even write me angry emails about it. And, people thought that I'm promoting a type of political correctness that they think is terrible and the ruin of our country. It's funny. I mean, I just thought that it was a little bit of verisimilitude. Since the 90s, there are a lot of schools that, you know, that use gender-neutral language and adopted certain kind of neologistic terms, and those terms are in currency. So, you know, so I was just trying to kind of represent what I thought it was like at a little liberal arts school, you know, without myself feeling kind of one way or the other about it.
Right. And frankly, we use first-year students a lot as an alternative to freshmen because, you know, I don't mind using alternative language. So as far as I was concerned, it wasn't a big deal, but I thought it was kind of interesting that you hit away at that. So let's talk a little bit about the baseball part of the book in terms of the fact that when I read the reviews, and by the way, congratulations on your reviews. I mean, I know that this is a few years back now, but your reviews were incredible. I mean, I found one that some guy, for whatever reason, went off on you. But with that exception, the reviews from across the country and beyond were just incredible. And one of the things that I found about the reviews is that most of them understood, yeah, this is a novel about baseball, but it's not just about baseball. But every now and then, somebody who was doing a very cursory review through your book would say a baseball novel. Help us understand your take on when you sat down to write this book, why baseball to tell this story, which could have been told with football, track, a whole number of different sports that I could think of.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it could, but I think the germ of the book was baseball and the baseball plot. You know, one of the central characters is the shortstop on the college team, Henry Scrimshander. You know, who is really on the ascent. He's about to become the first player from this college ever to be drafted. He's you know, he's on the verge of, you know, realizing his lifelong dream of playing professional baseball. Not to give too much away, because this happens pretty early in the book, he develops a kind of mental block, which prevents him from being able to throw the ball. And this idea of a baseball player who gets that kind of a block and is, you know, prevented by his own mind from achieving the things that everyone knows that he can achieve, that was the genesis of the whole book. And it so happened that just as I was beginning this book, this is something that has happened to a lot of really great professional players, as you know. Around 1999, 2000, 2001, just as I was starting this book, there were several really high-profile major leaguers to whom this happened. Rick Ankiel for the Cardinals, Chuck Knobloch playing for the Yankees, and the one that really got to me, Mark Wohlers, who was an all-star relief pitcher for the Braves. Fantastic, fantastic pitcher, threw 100 miles an hour, and one day couldn't do it. And I saw this happen when the Braves were playing my hometown Brewers, and Wohlers had been struggling, and the Braves brought him into a game that was already a blowout to try to you know, kind of help him regain his confidence a little bit. And he got out there and just could not do it. He was throwing the ball into the dirt. He was throwing it to the backstop. He was throwing it behind the batter. The only thing he could throw anywhere near the plate was a curveball. And it was just stunning that to be watching a human being just so at war with his own demons in such a public way, you know, with 30,000 people watching and on live television. And even though it was a hostile crowd, no one was really cheering when he, you know, threw another wild pitch, because everyone was just kind of stunned by this kind of like human drama that was happening. And I just thought, wow, this is something that has, to the best of my knowledge, never been written about in fiction before. You know, and it's just so rich, such a rich dramatization of human psychology, you know, and you know, analogous to what happens to all of us in our lives when we, you know, get afraid or get blocked and prevent ourselves from doing the things that we, you know, really can do, you know, and certainly analogous to stage fright or writer's block, you know, or anything that every artist, if they're any good, goes through. But here you have a situation where, you know, when it happens to an athlete, it happens in a way that's so much more kind of public and dramatic than it does for the writer sitting alone in her room. You know, so there's this beautiful kind of inner aspect and outer aspect of it. And so that was kind of the germ of the book. And so that was Henry. And I think there's, you know, so to your question, why baseball? You know, baseball, because that's just where I started this thing. But also I think there is, although there are various sports in which this kind of thing happens, I think baseball is almost the most tense or gives the most opportunities for this kind of, you know, doubt and self-questioning to creep in, you know, because the game does kind of move at a slow pace and the spotlight kind of moves around the field. It's not like basketball or football where everyone's kind of running around in a circle, crashing into each other. You kind of stand there and wait for your chance. And if you muck up your chance, you're screwed and everyone knows it. So I think there is something really psychologically crucifying about baseball for the individual, and it happens within a team environment. So a golfer or a tennis player is in the same kind of crucible, but what they're not doing when they're in that crucible is letting down their whole team. And that just adds a whole nother element to it that is just crushing. It's just crushing for these guys.
Now, that's very well put. So there's a college president in this novel, Gert Effenlight, and he plays a pivotal role in the book. Tell us a little bit about the relationship he has with a student. In any event, as a college president, I was thinking about that all the way through this thing. I thought, oh, man, is this guy going to get in trouble? But tell us about the relationship and why you inserted in this a relationship that turns out to be a gay romance.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, in a way, it happened. You know, it just kind of arose naturally in the writing of the book, pretty early in the composition. I was writing a baseball scene, and this was very, very early on, and I wanted the scene not to be told by one of the players who was on the field, you know, because when you're actually playing in a game, your thoughts are not that interesting. You know, you're thinking cover second, you know, there's two outs. What if they bunt? You know, so I wanted an observer, kind of neutral observer, to be watching this game and kind of telling us what's happening. And so I started writing from the point of view of this character, and the character turned out to be the college president. And, I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. You know, you may continue. You know, so I'm writing along and asking myself, all right, why is he at the game today? And it turned out that he was at the game because he had a sort of strange infatuation, which he didn't really understand himself, with one of the players on the team, you know, a young man who had just kind of captivated his attention. And he was, you know, heterosexual guy, and this was kind of strange to him, and he just had this curiosity about this person. And you know, it kind of just arose in my writing of the book. And you know, then as I started to think about it, I thought, well, boy, this actually really makes sense, you know, because I began the book with Mike and Henry and their relationship, which is you know, a really intense friendship and mentorship and rivalry, almost a kind of marriage between these two guys, really, even though they're both entirely straight and would reject the term. Their lives and their minds are so intertwined. And, you know, so I kind of realized that I was writing a book about the kind of varieties of male friendship across a whole spectrum. From, you know, from the antagonistic, like, you know, through close friendship, all the way over to the, like, frankly, romantic. And, you know, and of course, I was also writing my book in a kind of what I hoped was a sort of lighthearted dialogue with Moby Dick, which I think is certainly the preeminent American novel about male friendship. So this relationship that arose between Athelney and Owen kind of made sense to me. And, the thing that I like about the friendship between Athelney and Owen is that, the person who you think going into it is going to have all the power, the college president who is older and more worldly and in this position of authority, turns out to not be the person who has the power at all. It turns out that Owen is the person who is kind of making all the calls and leading the way throughout their entire relationship. And so that dynamic really makes that work for me.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and my guest today is Chad Harbach, author of the best-selling novel, The Art of Fielding. I want to jump to something that is not necessarily about the plot. It's more about the mechanics of the book. But in all the interviews I've ever done with authors, I have never raised this question for the simple fact that I never had an opportunity to read an article called How a Book is Born. And Keith Gessen, your good friend, who's writing this little story of the making of The Art of Fielding, opens up by talking about Keith Hayes, a graffiti artist once upon a time who goes professional with St. Martin's Press and then Little Brown and winds up with the task of doing the jacket cover for your book, and apparently with a directive. And I'm curious whether that was your directive or Little Brown's directive. I assume it's Little Brown's, that baseball not be anywhere on the jacket of the book. Tell us about that story and what role authors play in this and what your take was on that decision.
Yeah, well, it's funny. My book, when I finished my manuscript and I started sending it around to agents to try to get an agent, I actually got turned down by a lot of agents before I found mine. At the time, it was not at all clear to me that that my book was ever going to have any sort of wide audience, because it was this weird book that was a college book and a baseball book, and it had this gay romance in it. And in fact, when my editor Michael Peach at Little Brown bought the book, he said, "I know that there are three types of books that don't sell: baseball books, campus novels, and gay novels. And your book manages to be all three, but we're gonna try to make it work." The idea is that although there are of course like some great, well known and classic baseball novels, in fact, almost everyone in this country who buys literary novels is a woman, for one thing, and of course there are many female baseball fans, but these two groups of people, the literary novel readers and the baseball fans, do not tend to overlap very much. And so all along, the people at Little Brown were very emphatic about saying, this isn't a book about baseball. It's a book about love. And I was like, well, that's true. I really feel that myself. And I really feel that the book is not just about baseball, but, what's going to happen when people turn to page one and we're on a baseball diamond? But the cover was part of this. Certainly like the publisher, they were very, very wise and correct in doing so. But they knew that a lot of people who read books, who read fiction, were going to be scared off by a novel that was heavily about baseball, and that they needed to try to convince them that it wasn't all about baseball. And so the directives about the jacket were part of that.
Well, that's funny you mentioned that, because as I told you before we started the interview, I received your book as a gift, and that's the reason why I read it. But I saw it on the stand and absolutely assumed that even though it was called The Art of Fielding, I didn't know what that meant, but it wasn't about baseball. So tell us about N Plus One. I want to make sure we get a plug in for your magazine that you co-founded and you co-edit. If anybody wants to find it, first of all, how do they do that? Well, that's easy these days. You just Google N Plus One. That's what I did. But but tell us about it. How long has this been up and running, and what do you do?
Yeah, well, it's a magazine that was founded in 2004 by some friends of mine and I, and it's a magazine of literature and politics and culture that we founded in part because it actually in the early 2000s, the kind of, you know, there's a great tradition in this country of the little magazine since, 19th century as just being a kind of just important part of the intellectual culture and, you know, kind of just really, you know, giving kind of thoughtful and independent views about literature and politics and culture and just kind of the way we live now. And in the early 2000s, there weren't any of these. And my friends and I were like, you know, well, why not us? And, you know, we felt like we were all writers. We weren't necessarily magazine people. We were all writers who were kind of frustrated by the assignments that we were able to get from other magazines. You know, we felt that no one was really allowing us to kind of write what was really in our hearts or what we were really deeply thinking about. And, we, you know, we started this thing and we didn't know if anyone was ever going to care or read it. And it turned out we sold out the first issue and 11 years later, we're still cranking along. Yeah, I mean, it comes out three times a year. It's fiction and mostly kind of essays, just people thinking deeply about their lives and the kind of worlds in which they move. I love it. I think it's the best thing going.
You wrote an essay recently called MFA versus NYC, referring to the two different publishing worlds out there when it comes to literary fiction in terms of learning the craft, I should say, not publishing worlds, but learning the craft, either the MFA programs, and by the way, we have one here at Boise State that's small, but it's highly regarded. In fact, I'll send you a copy of our literary magazine after the show. And then, of course, there's New York City. Help us understand what you're getting at in that article.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental idea really is about how writers survive and make money. And, you know, because I think that those, the kind of material conditions like that, the how you make your living, you know, really affects how you're going to think about your life and therefore the work that you do and the writing that you do. And what we've seen in the past 20 years is an explosion of MFA programs and writing programs within the university. You know, there were a few handfuls of these things in the 80s, and now there are thousands of them. So it means that a lot of fiction writers these days are earning their living by teaching in a university. And so they're kind of ensconced in that community as opposed to, and some writers, you know, some writers are kind of ensconced in the New York publishing world and their kind of thoughts and efforts are kind of directed at that sphere. So what I was trying to do was just kind of lay out that situation and say, wow, look, this is a new situation. You know, maybe 50 years ago, 80 years ago, it was Hollywood versus NYC, right?
Right.
Now we have these two kind of big ways to make money as a writer. And so I wanted to do a sort of amateur sociology and say, all right, like how do these people live and what kind of work comes out of these different realms?
Well, we've run out of time, Chad, but I'm just delighted that you could share with us a few moments of your time. And thanks so much for sharing the book with our listeners and potential readers. Again, it's The Art of Fielding, a novel by Chad Harback. Chad, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Chad Harback. Next week, Pamela Newkirk, author of Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Oda Benga. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. Our show is now on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Find us by going to prx.org and searching for Reader's Corner.